We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning. These headphones were last being worn by a midget, I swear.
They are adjustable, John.
Well, I'm trying to adjust them here. I just can't get them around my big head. That's the problem.
I'm not sure we have a pair that really will go around that big head of yours. So, speaking of big heads, the RNC this last week. How could you miss it?
That was quite a transition, wasn't it?
I liked it.
Yeah. Well, we had George Bush and Dick Cheney and all the other various characters doing what John Kerry should have been doing, which is launching frontal assaults on their opponent all week. And meantime, we had enormous protests outside the Madison Square Garden and the convention site. Not just on Sunday, when you had upwards of 250,000, potentially quite a few more. Marching peacefully, but all week long you had nearly 2,000 arrests, some total, I think it's 1,700 something this week, but by and large peaceful protests. There have been some complaints, some threats of civil suits, but not nearly as bad as it could have been, I think, in terms of the overwhelming police presence that was there. It's a good week for the protesters. A lot of stories that we'll start hearing, I'm sure, as folks come back from New York.
And yet, not surprising that the corporate media didn't really cover any of the issues that the protesters were trying to bring up.
No, they really didn't. There was very little coverage after Sunday. The coverage of the Sunday march was excellent. There was as large a crowd as there was. Although I think USA Today got the booby prize for saying that there were thousands of marchers. that's pretty lame. But by and large, it was pretty straightforward coverage of that. But then, when you have over 1,000 people arrested on Tuesday, which was the day that was dedicated to civil disobedience, that particular round of protests got very little coverage outside New York itself, and almost no coverage. You know, it was just lumped as anti-Bush protesters without saying what people were upset about. You had on Sunday, because the sponsoring group was United for Peace and Justice, which is an anti-war group, you had, you know, the focus on Iraq, but really after that, during the week, there was very little acknowledgement of what people were upset about. And part of that is because people were upset about so many different things for the Bush administration that it's difficult to summarize them all quickly. And, you know, that kind of complexity is difficult for mainstream media to get its tiny little mind around sometimes.
All right. Well, one of the issues you think might have come up is things like Medicare, which made this morning's paper.
Yeah, it did. 17% rise in Medicare costs this coming year for the Plan B, which affects most seniors and disabled as well. And this comes on the heels, remember, of the prescription drug plan, which will vastly increase drug prices this year for a number of Medicare recipients as well. It's supposed to be a Medicare savings, but in effect, it's a partial privatization of Medicare instead, and
plus it
really leaves seniors at the mercy of the private companies that they're getting their drug coverage through.
It forces some of the seniors to pay out of pocket for
exactly.
of their drug costs, which was the intent of the Republicans who drafted the plan.
Yeah, so what you have, the net effect for people's pocketbooks is that you have these two hits at the same time for a portion of the electorate that votes regularly and hopefully will remember this come November, because this is something that is directly traceable to the Republican philosophy of having such an enormous deficit and such reckless spending that there's no money available left in the pot and you have to raise it from ordinary people rather than the people who can afford it.
Yeah, the paper pointed out this morning it's the highest increase for Medicare in its history.
Yep, so, yeah, absolutely.
Quite the banner day. The other thing that's in the news you can't miss is the what happened in Russia with the school.
In North Ossetia, which is a province next door to Chechnya. And it's interesting. We were having a conversation before we went on the air about how easy or difficult it would be to have something like that happen in the United States. And you have the availability of weapons, certainly, and you fear what the government would do if we had any kind of incident like that here. But at the same time, this is a situation that was made vastly worse by the Russian government's response to it. And this is a part of the world where it's much more proximate to guns and the people who are willing to use them in this way.
Well, in the case of this incident, you have Ossetia, the province where it occurred, mm-hmm. was right next door to Chechnya.
Right.
And so it makes it very easy for the people who wanted to carry out this attack to just cross a land border, excuse me, and then they would be there. And a lot of folks here, because I know that when I talk to people, they're always saying, well, what if a terrorist attack occurs before the election and then George Bush can use it and carry the election on his behalf, et cetera, et cetera. And I have to look at them and I think, you know, I don't think that's going to happen. I think the chances of that happening are so vanishingly small. One of the reasons is that the part of the world where the United States is attacking right now is so far away and so difficult for those people to come over here. It's not like Chechnya, which borders on Russia. It's a very different situation. And the other thing that people forget is that we are a surveillance state. For example, to get into a school here, you often have to pass through metal detectors, and there are cameras inside the school, et cetera, et cetera. And there are multiple checks. There are, you know, are armed guards in a lot of schools, et cetera. So, I mean, it's very,
although,
very difficult.
I think you'll find a lot of schools in the Seattle area where that's not true at all.
Yeah, but I think the likeliness of, for example, people from Iraq or from Palestine, et cetera, being able to come over here and do the same kind of attack is so vanishingly small. It kind of brings up the issue of why we even worry about terrorist attacks most of the time.
Well, there's certainly a lot of paranoia about the election in particular, and I use the term paranoia advisedly because the chances are so small. And because there's so much mistrust, I think, particularly among people on the left, of what the Bush administration might do to manipulate a situation like that, that it's really a worst case kind of scenario, but it's one that is extremely unlikely to happen. Even the kind of imbroglio that we had in the year 2000 is something that took a confluence of a number of unlikely events to take place. The chances are overwhelmingly large that this is going to be a fairly normal election in terms of how it's carried out.
Yeah, and people are always saying, well, what about the World Trade Center bombings? And I have to look at them and I say, you know, have you read anything about what these guys went through to get this done? You know, I mean, there were so many things actually going against the organization of something like that, that it was something of a, I won't say a miracle, but something of a...
Oh, it was a long shot.
It was a very, very long shot that they were actually able to carry it out.
And it took a fair amount of incompetence on the behalf of US officials, police authorities for it to take place too.
Yeah. And I think that there's just so much more vigilance now that's not likely to occur again.
But it really is a testimony to how successful the fear campaign of the Bush administration has been over the past 3 years, that this is something that's on the tip of a lot of people's tongues.
Yeah.
That we've had it hammered into us over and over again that, you know, even though as horrific as the World Trade Center, the 9/11 bombings were, and we're coming up on the third anniversary of that this week, you know, we have more people die in traffic accidents in an ordinary month.
Oh yeah.
The chances that
or for example, not having health insurance.
Yeah. exactly. I mean, there are so many other concerns which are more relevant to the welfare of ordinary Americans that are not being paid attention to because we're so focused on this.
Well, and you know, one thing that was tied into 9-1-1-2 that seems to have fallen off the radar was the anthrax attacks. You know, that, again, when that started pointing back towards people in the U.S. who had carried it out, you know, it just dropped off the radar. No, we're not going to follow through on that investigation. So I think that's one of the things that underlying feeds people's fear is the fact that, you know, our government didn't follow through on finding out who were the real culprits on that.
Yeah, although at the same time, I mean, this is something that was, you know, terrifying the country for a couple of months, and how many people wound up dying as a result of that, 4 or 5? I mean, it was just, you know, vanishingly small in terms of the number of people who were actually affected by it.
True, but it was, I mean, if you look at, like, potentially what it could have done, what it said about, you know, that you had somebody that was within the military-industrial complex that, you know, had access to this stuff.
Oh, and, sure. Absolutely.
And I can't even send something from my home now over a pound, you know, where I could before. I mean, that's
the mail,
it changed,
yeah.
You know, it changed the way that our mail carriers deal with everything.
Yeah.
So, anyway, let's move along to, how about to This Week in Iraq?
I'm going to talk for a little bit about some of the things that have happened while the attacks in Najaf have been occurring. What the Bush administration doesn't want you to know in this campaign season is that U.S. troop deaths have gone up by a lot in Iraq this year. It is now averaging 2 deaths a day. 66 U.S. troops died in the month of August. The average since the start of the war last February is 55 men dying a month, men and women, I should say. The total, as of Friday, the official total, at any rate, is 976 dead, and it's expected to reach 1,000 within the next 2 to 3 weeks if it continues with 2 men dying, men and women, dying every day. Now, I should also say, too, that an unknown number of Iraqis and Iraqi civilians have died somewhere above the number of 9,000 to 10,000, although some folks would say it's closer to 3 to 4 times that number. And they're still dying in several places that are very, very dangerous for Iraqi civilians, men, women, and children, not just the city of Najaf, but also Basra, Baghdad, Fallujah, the city of Mosul, where there are almost daily attacks now, the cities of Samarra, Kufa, many other places where it's not just the rebels who engage in roadside bombings that injure civilians, but also U.S. military, including U.S. military planes, which are now routinely bombing the cities of Fallujah and Samarra in a strategy that, I have to say, echoes the Clinton administration's strategy against Iraq all throughout his administration, which was don't deal with the problems at hand, just send the bombers in.
Yeah, and we're talking about most of the major cities in Iraq at this point.
Yes. Excuse me. Also this week, some analysts were interviewed by reporters, and they said, you know, the insurgency, which I'm going to call a guerrilla war, which is what it is, has been widening. Many analysts now put the number of guerrillas fighting U.S. troops at an almost equal number of U.S. troops, so somewhere over the number of 100,000, not around 1,000 to 2,000, as the Bush administration keeps saying. Also this week, it was reported that the guerrillas control all of Anbar province. We talked about this a few weeks ago. Anbar province makes up some 40% of Iraqi territory, and it includes the cities of Fallujah, Ramadi, and Samarra. Now, just saying that the guerrillas control the cities of Fallujah, Ramadi, and Samarra is not giving you enough of a picture of what's actually happened in those places. There is no governor of Anbar province. And there are no mayors in the cities of Fallujah, Ramadi, and Samarra. They've either been intimidated to leave office or assassinated. There are no government buildings in the cities of Fallujah, Ramadi, and Samarra. They have either been taken over by the guerrillas or they have been destroyed by the guerrillas. There are no Iraqi National Guard headquarters and no Iraqi police headquarters in those cities either. There are also no patrols by Iraqi police or National Guard. The Fallujah Brigade, which was set up by the U.S. military in a compromise when they withdrew from Fallujah. The Fallujah Brigade, which was supposed to patrol Fallujah and maintain control there on behalf of the interim government, now does not even go inside the city of Fallujah. They lost their headquarters to the guerrillas, and so they had to move outside the city, and they maintain a few checkpoints on the periphery, but that's all. So that is the situation in Anbar province. Now, I also want to point out that the city of Mosul, the third largest city in Iraq, is still being hotly contested by the Sunni guerrillas. There are daily attacks and running battles there, and or roadside bombs or car bombings, etc., in the city of Mosul. So we might expect that to fall eventually to the guerrillas as well. The guerrillas have also shut down Iraq's oil infrastructure and nearly all of Iraq's oil exports in the past 2 weeks. There have been multiple attacks on oil pipelines, particularly last weekend when there were five or six attacks in a row in the southern half of the country. Now, I should point out that the attacks on the southern oil infrastructure have come mostly in the last month or so during the time that the U.S. military was busy destroying most of the city of Najaf. So we might reasonably assume that it's not the Sunni insurgency that's been carrying out those attacks, but disgruntled Shiites. Now, what happens when you shut down the oil flow in Iraq is that you're turning off the main source of revenue for the interim government. At the same time, for every day that the oil is not flowing to the export terminals, Iraq loses some $70 million in revenue for the interim government. In addition, many of the bombings are occurring not just to the export pipelines and facilities, but also to internal pipelines within the country. So there's not as much oil flowing to the Baiji refinery, for example, the largest refinery in the country. That means that there's going to be shortages of oil and fuel for the local population. And that's particularly bad in the summertime when temperatures are high, people need the fuel for their air conditioners and to keep their generators going so that they can refrigerate food, etc., and so that they can keep their cars running so they can get to their jobs, and that's been a major problem. So this combination of two things, having lost almost half of the country to the guerrillas, is now in guerrilla hands, and losing the oil money, the government of the U.S.-appointed president of the interim government, Ayad al-Lawi, he has finally decided that it might be a good thing to negotiate with the Sunni insurgents in particular. So we had an announcement this week that Ayad al-Lawi had said that he has now been negotiating with Sunni insurgents who control the cities of Fallujah, Ramadi, and Samarra. He's in talks to try to get them to soften their stance and allow Iraqi police and National Guard into those cities, etc., etc. So far, he's had made no progress on that front. He's also been negotiating with Shiite leaders, and he was trying to negotiate with Muqtada al-Sadr to get his militia to lay down their arms. In negotiating with the Shiites, however, he's encountered a major problem. There are two Shiite groups supported by the United States, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, and the Dawah Party, both of whom have contacts with the Pentagon and the CIA. Those two groups would prefer to see Muqtada al-Sadr dead and completely off the scene. On the other hand, the rest of the Shiite leadership doesn't mind having Muqtada al-Sadr around, though they're not great friends with him. And of course, Muqtada al-Sadr would not prefer to be dead. And so Ayad al-Lawi is encountering a major split in the Shiite community, and that's giving him some problems in negotiating with them as well. So in the next few weeks, we'll see where that's headed and see if this interim government can survive to January. And at that point, if elections can be carried out when half of the country is in the hands of a guerrilla band.
What are the chances, do you think, of the I don't want to say a catastrophic failure on the behalf of the Americans, but a significant setback to the point where our media have to carry some of these stories before the election, because
we're very close. I mean, there was a group this week in the UK, a group of, I believe, former military men who advised the government They came out with a report this week that said the most likely scenario for Iraq is absolute civil war and disintegration. So when you've got groups saying things like that, I realize that I'm not the only one. It's kind of nice to actually read that. Of course, that's not ever going to be carried in the U.S. press, at least not until that situation actually occurs, if it does occur. But chances are looking better every day for that to actually happen.
Yeah, and I'm wondering about the possible effect of that on the U.S. election, sort of October surprise in reverse for the Bush administration, because their fortunes are so closely tied to to the decision to invade Iraq in the first place.
I think it's very possible. That's all I can say is I think it's very, very possible that we're going to start seeing Iraq dominate the headlines again before the election, and it's not going to be good news.
Well, not that it's been good news in the past either. Anything else on Iraq?
No, let's move on.
All right, well, talking about elections, we've got numerous local ones that are kind of having some interesting little turns to them. one of it being, for those of us that have TVs, Deborah Senn, they've been having some commercials just bad-mouthing Deborah Senn, and you get the impression that maybe the insurance companies are involved in that.
Yeah, nobody knows for sure, because the group that's in charge of, or the group that's been putting together these commercials and has spent more than $500,000 so far and has said that they're going to continue their campaign, they're likely to spend over $1 million on these TV ads in the next couple weeks. This group has not filed any public disclosure commission reports, so nobody knows who they are or where they get their funding. All they know is that the guy who is the director of the group also is a consultant for Sheriff Dave Reichert in his run for Congress. Now, there's a lot of people, including folks from the Senn campaign committee, who think that it's probably the insurance industry that's funding some of these commercials, and I say that that's probably also true, because you have to ask, you know, where would they get all this money on such short notice? Here in the state of Washington, well, it would have to be people with a lot of money and a really big grudge against Deborah Senn, and that pretty much narrows it down to the insurance industry.
Yep.
Yeah, and I think it also kind of points out this whole thing about, you know, TV commercials in political campaigns. Should we even allow it? I mean,
well, we had the Swift vote controversy this past month also, where it's the same kind of thing, where you have this rump group that we're going to be seeing more of this unless or until something is done, where you have this rump group that has murky financing that probably won't be revealed until after the election, that can come out and pretty much say anything they want, whether it's true or not, about a candidate, because we've learned that lying in a campaign is protected by freedom of speech in the Constitution.
Right.
That's a court ruling. And so we're very vulnerable to these kind of these kind of stealth attacks.
Yeah.
So, and you mentioned Reichert, Dave Reichert, and he had a little
meltdown,
a little incident this week.
Yeah, he had a little meltdown. He was going to be participating in a debate with two of his challengers on the Republican side of the race for Congress in his district, and
this is the 8th district on the east side.
Yeah, and instead of actually going and participating, regardless of what you think of your challengers and whether or not you think they're telling the truth, Reichert just stood up and said, "Well, I'm not going to participate in this debate. These guys are liars, and this is terrible, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." And he stormed out, which I think is kind of an interesting indication of what he might do if he's elected for Congress. It's so much the kind of cop mentality. Either you play by my rules or we're not playing at all, you know?
Yeah, which is the exact opposite of what you've got to do as a legislator, where you have to cut deals, where you have to work every day with people that you are ideologically opposed to, and you have to find compromises.
Yeah. So I think it's very telling about what we could expect from Dave Reichert if he's elected.
Yeah, it was an interesting little strategic move there, and
he's got a real reputation, I have to say, from editorial board interviews with him as something of a lightweight, a career cop who sort of stumbled his way into an elected position when the King County Sheriff was made an elected position a few years back. who has been surrounded by people since then who've been telling him how wonderful he is, and he's kind of let it go to his head.
A lot of surface and not much substance.
Though. Yeah, there's you know, he's got a really pretty head of hair, but there's not a lot there. And it really underscores that there's a very strong chance for a Democrat, probably Dave Ross, who's the leading person on the Democratic side right now to get that nomination, has a very good chance of winning that race and having that seat go to the Democrats.
Right, but I think I read in your review that you don't rate him entirely as a solid Democrat. But
we'll talk about that next week when we talk about endorsements. But he's a very centrist Democrat.
The other thing that was been making the papers is the candidacy battle between Alice Wolt and Helen Summers.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised to pick up the PI and see them just lash out against Alice Wolt and you know, talk about this myth of the only reason why Alice Wolt is running is because the SEIU, the Service Employees Union, put her up to it.
or the other variant of that is that Frank Chop put her up to it, which supposedly
is
about the same thing. It is ridiculous. I mean, Helen Summers has had her control of the purse strings in Olympia through her committee assignment for the past several sessions, and has made a lot of enemies in that time because of the social service cuts, because of
I think the biggest problem is that people perceive that the Democrats in Olympia, led by Helen Summers on the budget writing committee in the House, have not stood up to a major attack by the Republicans to cut social services
and Gary Locke,
and to still ensure that businesses can be given their tax breaks. And really, somebody needed to put their foot down in the Democratic Party and say, no, this is not what we stand for, and to really stand up to the governor and say, are you a Democrat or are you a Republican?
Yeah.
And Helen Summers did not do that. And I think that there are plenty of people in her district and all over the state who are unhappy with that.
Yeah,
and I would
Alice
say
Wolt
that that's the main
chance.
Reason why Alice Wolt has our support and support of other folks.
Yeah, and she has a very good chance of winning, too.
Yeah.
I think she's got a lot of support in that district.
Yeah.
Well, it's one we will all keep watching very closely. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, who are co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State comes out every other week. The issue that came out this week has our primary endorsements in them. We'll talk about those on the air next week. You can find it at bookstores and cafes and places where you get free publications. You can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions or comments or tips, or you want to volunteer,
or you want to donate,
whatever, give us a call. Our voicemail is area code
9-0-3-9-4-6-1. And you know, we're always looking for volunteers too. Right now we have need of volunteers to do distribution for us, to take papers around to various spots and set up some distribution routes for us. If that sounds like something you'd like to do, personally, I think one of the most favorite jobs I've ever done for Eat the State. You can also give us a call at 903-9461, or you can come to one of our business meetings, which is on the third Tuesday of the month. Third Wednesday of the month at University Baptist Church in the University District. And you can find that address on our website.
The distribution routes, give us an example of one that you'd be looking for.
Well, right now we're looking for some folks to help out on Capitol Hill, which I think would be pretty easy and pretty fine place to do it.
There's three different routes, actually, on Capitol Hill, because we have a lot of businesses there that take the paper.
Now, there's a route along Broadway, a route along the Pike Pine Corridor, and one along 15th. So if anybody thinks they can do that or wants to help out with a downtown route or Queen Anne or any of those areas.
Quickly, what would be involved with that if someone were to pick one of those?
You pick up some papers at the church, and you take them around to various places.
Every other week, and it needs to be somebody who's reliable and able to do that every issue.
Yeah.
All right. So just want to make sure people know what's involved before they sign on the dotted line.